This is ContactTalkRadio.com, consciousness in action, and you are taking action into your consciousness by tuning into Contact Talk Radio.
And on TuneIn.com, Hing.fm, and UpSnap Mobile.
Contact Talk Radio.
Welcome to You Are What You Love, your window into the future of spirituality. We're going to talk to you about your life and the evolution of your soul while we bring alive the essence of eternal truth. So here is your host, the author of You Are What You Love, Waishali.
Aloha, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of You Are What You Love. And obviously, this is not Waishali. This is her dad hosting today for her, and delighted to have you with us today. We have a great guest for you to enjoy. He's a well-known constitutional attorney. He served our country during the Reagan administration, and he's authored many books, and his most recent book is Restore the Republic. Restore the Republic exposes how over the past 80 years we've moved away from the concept of self-government, of for and by the people, to an unconstrained federal government with hundreds of agencies, millions of regulations, and in current years, the president, who's on a wild spending spree, adding more than $5 trillion during his first term in office. And so we've come a long way from sovereign individual, sovereign state, and here to talk to us about restoring the republic and many other things. Welcome, Jonathan E. Moore. It is a pleasure to have you with us today, Jonathan.
Well, it's great to be with you, Joe.
And for the folks that are tuned in, if you want to call in, there is a guest line for our callers. Let me get it in front of me here. It is 425?
No, that's 877.
Okay. It's 877. Thanks, Janet. Keep me on the right track here. Janet is with me in the production booth here today. For all of you listening who would like to speak to Jonathan, our toll-free number, wherever you are in the United States and the world, is 877-230-3062. Jonathan, this book, Restore the Republic, I'm holding it in my hand. I've read it many times. It's an amazing book. And all of you listening, if you have not gotten this book, Restore the Republic, they can go to Amazon.com and buy it. Is that right, Jonathan?
That's right.
Right. Jonathan, you've been traveling. I know you have in recent months, and we're so glad that you've taken the time to spend this time with us. As you've been traveling around the country, what is your sense of what's going on? I know you've addressed literally thousands of people since we were together here in California. What kind of concerns are our citizens expressing to you, especially when you speak to them about restoring the republic?
Well, I think the most common sentiment people are experiencing is a sense of helplessness, basically that regardless of who they vote for, the nation will inevitably head down this fiscal path to ruin, and that the core values of our republic, well, the essence of what it is to be a republic has been lost, which of course is that latter point is the theme of my book, and there seems to be considerable understanding and pathos, I would say, about the loss of our republic. It is the case that this magnificent nation, which we have, that was created based on republican principles, small r, in which people were to be sovereign, the state was to be their servant, and it was to be a limited government, that is, a government of express powers in Article 1, and it was not to exceed those, and the bulk of power was to be left to the states and the people. The federal government was to perform only specific functions, was not to delegate the powers that were specified for the individual branches of the federal government to entities outside of the government. Then, stepping forward to the present, we now find that the government is run principally by over 250 independent regulatory commissions that are unelected and yet possess the bulk of legislative, executive, and judicial powers combined. So we have literally transformed our government from a limited federal republic that the Constitution prescribes into an unlimited bureaucratic oligarchy. And that is our ruin. That is the reason why we can't seem to constrain regulation. It's the reason why we can't seem to get a hold on the ever-expanding cost of the government. It's these bureaucracies which administer the entitlements and administer all of the legislative programs to regulate industry that have gotten so out of hand that we have destroyed the engine of progress, which is free enterprise, and we have taken away our future by promising far more than this government is able to provide. And so it's depressing, and I think most people out there are aware that the problem is extraordinary, are aware that the costs of the government are unsustainable, and that we face ruin unless we're able to reverse the course. But they have little faith in either of the two parties, and little faith, virtually no faith at all, in the Congress of the United States. And they're disheartened. A lot of people are sickened by it, and they express that to me quite regularly.
That is an unbelievable summary of, I think, of how most of us feel. There's no question that the central issue in this presidential election year is all about the bigger government and more regulation. During the first 3 years in office, Mr. Obama's added 11,327 pages of new regulations. And included in that, just for example, are 18 pages just to define a full-time employee. You talk about micromanaging life. You know, you and I are believers, because we've talked before, we're believers in dreamers. We're believers in people that followed their dreams. The founding fathers were dreamers. The pilgrims were dreamers. And for all of you just joining, we have Jonathan Ebor, the author of the great book on restoring the republic, with us for this full hour. Feel free to call us in or get on the chat room and talk to us. Jonathan has really nailed the root causes of why we're in the difficulties we are, and it's been undergoing for decades. And Jonathan, what should we be demanding of our elected officials to get us restoring the republic? What are some of the things that you would suggest our listeners pick up on when they're talking to the congressman or their representative?
Well, you know, one of the things that is indispensable to saving this nation as it was to founding it is a stellar character. We have a president who smiles like a Cheshire cat and who is lying to us rather regularly and refuses to take responsibility for leadership. He refuses to submit to Congress a budget plan that would balance the budget. He refuses to cut any programs. He refuses to inform people that his call for hundreds of billions of dollars, over $450 billion in new make-work jobs through government, are totally unaffordable. He refuses to admit to the public that the Obamacare plan that he's just instituted has had its budget revised multiple times and is now vastly in excess of the budget that the Congress approved. He refused to admit to the American people that we are within a decade of financial ruin, and that unless we take seriously our present financial predicament and take immediate steps to reduce the size and scope of the federal government, we will face that ruin. So there's a lack of integrity in that. On the other side, we have a politician in the form of Mitt Romney, was our only choice other than Mr. Obama, and he is not providing us with the specific details necessary to assure us that the nation will achieve a dramatic change in the size and scope of government. He needs to show greater leadership himself. I think the principal problem that he has is that he is not championing, as if he believes to his core, a revitalization of the republic. If you believe sincerely in a restoration of the constitutional republic that the framers designed for us, you would do a number of things that he's not doing. You would, for example, go to the areas of this country where there is high unemployment and where there is little hope, and you would go into those areas and you would meet with civic leaders and you would explain in detail your plan, which would be to create enterprise zones in those areas where the federal government would eliminate the corporate income tax for companies that would move in and hire people, and would reduce substantially state and local taxes in cooperation with state and local leaders to create these enterprise zones to employ the people who so desperately need jobs. You would show how you would remove regulation that is stymieing the growth of enterprise, so that specifically we can see how the coal and natural gas production inside the United States could be increased, how small businesses now blocked from entering into markets in competition with major companies that are protected by government regulation would be allowed to enter by eliminating the regulatory restraints that are blocking them. And you would show precisely how you would transform the United States economically, not to depend on increases in taxation, which will destroy the engine for employment and hiring people, but how you would grow the American economic pie by expanding enterprise and competitiveness of this country. And you would use the bully pulpit of the White House to fight for freedom and free enterprise in the United States. That's the kind of leadership that would win this election for Mitt Romney. And that, unfortunately, is not what he's doing. He is our only choice for those of us who believe in less government. I'm not saying that I would vote for Obama. I recognize in Obama a person who will lead us to ruin. He's accelerated the growth of the government faster than George Bush. To show I'm not a partisan here, George Bush commenced this ruinous course, and he irresponsibly allowed the regulatory establishment to grow wild during his years in office. He was a Reagan Republican in name only. Indeed, he was one of the most liberal presidents the United States has ever had. He was certainly more of an expansionist for government than Bill Clinton was. But Obama is sort of a George Bush on steroids. He has vastly expanded the government beyond even the wildest dreams, I think, of George Bush, and this is unsustainable. And that's where Obama promises to go. We heard nothing at the Democratic National Convention about austerity measures necessary to save the republic. There was nothing but a party going on when people are unemployed to the tune of 9.6% in South Carolina or in North Carolina alone.
Well, you know, I could not agree with you more. What I want to tell our listeners, you're listening to Jonathan Ebord, our special guest, author of Restore the Republic. He's getting right down to the nitty-gritty, the root of our problems today. And he's absolutely right. Both political parties have been involved in this disaster. And to give you a little perspective, before, if you out there listening to me don't think we're in trouble, next time you go fill up your car with gas, it's right there in your face. The United States of America has more natural resources, gas and coal and fossil fuels, than the rest of the world put together. We have the technology, the know-how, the expertise to extract it efficiently and safely, and it has been prevented by this president. This president deliberately shut the offshore drilling rigs off when BP had their accident, right, Jonathan? And then he shut all of them down. It's like if an airplane crashed at LAX, that you ground all airplanes. It was craziness. And this same president goes to the country of Brazil, gives them $10 billion, and says, go do some offshore drilling, and they will be your biggest customer. This is a guy, this Mr. Obama, who's promoting a green philosophy, a green ideology. He wants us to get us off, like Mr. Gore, off of fossil fuels and out of the internal combustion engine because of this bogus climate warming, phony religion.
It's a situation. If you understand where a person has come from, you can oftentimes understand what motivates their actions. And there's a book by Edward Klein, who used to be the New York Times Magazine editor, that's quite good, called The Amateur. And it explains Obama's background. And Barack Obama, you know, one of the most amazing things is David Axelrod, who's the political chief for Barack Obama and orchestrated principally his campaign, first campaign, and now the second campaign, is a master at propaganda, essentially.
Yeah.
And what he's done is he's taken Barack Obama and he's transformed him into something that Barack Obama simply is not. And so when people look to him and are disappointed, they're disappointed because he's not fulfilling the public persona that he projects. And the reason for that is not Barack Obama. Barack Obama was an upper-middle-class kid, and so was Michelle Obama. Barack Obama went to an elite high school in Hawaii, and Michelle Obama went to an elite high school in Chicago. They went on to Ivy League schools. Barack Obama was an extremely liberal politician. And he left the university, went to the University of Chicago to be a law professor, and during that time learned about politics at the feet of Reverend Jeremiah Wright and his Trinity United Church of Christ in Chicago. Reverend Jeremiah Wright is the author of a theory called liberation theology, in which he professes Marxism on racial lines. He believes that all of the wealth in the United States needs to be redistributed from white America to black America, and that the United States is a colonial power that has oppressed blacks and other minorities worldwide. He is an anti-Semite, and he preaches all of these things from the pulpit. And Barack Obama very routinely attended his church, was married there to Michelle Obama, and worshipped at the feet of this Reverend Jeremiah Wright. He borrowed the phraseology that Wright uses to perfect his ability at speaking. He even uses some of those same terms to this day. He was brought up in politics by Jesse Jackson, who allowed him to speak every Saturday at Operation Push in Chicago to hone his speaking skills. And once he had perfected them sufficiently to cause audiences at Operation Push to respond favorably, Jackson arranged for him to go around the country and speak at different churches around the country, which he did do, and at each occasion he began with the statement, "I send you greetings from Reverend Jeremiah Wright in Chicago." Now, this man did this for 20 years, worshipped at the feet of Jeremiah Wright. It became a political liability when he was running for Congress, Senate, but became a major liability that he had to dispense with when he ran for president, and so he snubbed Wright. But in Obama, we have a person who's very narcissistic, who really adores himself and believes himself right to the expense of everyone else. And he is also a person who's not just indicative of liberal Democrats in America. He's beyond that. He is a person who fundamentally believes that the Constitution of the United States and that the history of the United States is oppressive, and that the solution is to create a European-style socialist state in this country. If liberated in a second term from the need to seek political acquiescence for future service, he can aspire to those things that he couldn't aspire to in his first years. And he wishes to do that. He hasn't disowned his associations. He spoke before the Democratic Socialists of America. He was a representative of the New Party, which was a wing of the Acorn Group, and is so far left, it's extremely amazing that anyone could possibly accept this guy. But David Axelrod repackaged him as a conciliator. They called his affiliation with the socialist groups and his advocacy of this Marxist agenda community organizing. And they called his association with Reverend Jeremiah Wright merely superficial. This was the church that he went to. And they called his prior associations with people who advocated the destruction of the United States and characterized this nation as a colonial power that had to be brought down as simple passing acquaintances. And instead they say of him that he's a man who can unite people who are divided on political grounds, that he united his own family, that his mother and father were at each other's throats and Barack stepped in and calmed the disagreement. All of this is mythology. At the Democratic National Convention, Michelle Obama went further with the same mythology from Axelrod, and that is, we were poor when we got out of school. We had a car that was rusting out. We had to get furniture out of a dumpster. Oh, really? I guess that accounts for why that furniture ended up in an over $250,000 two-bedroom condominium that they purchased. Or how about the $1.5 million mansion in Hyde Park that they moved to from the $250,000 condominium that they owned? Are these people who are poor, are they like the unemployed Americans? Do they really have that history? Do they suspect that we'll believe it? Well, apparently the media took it hook, line, and sinker with a tear in their eyes. But this is all rubbish. It's propaganda. And these people who will spin these disingenuous tales lack the character necessary to be a George Washington or a Thomas Jefferson or a Ronald Reagan and transform this country in the midst of a crisis. They will do what is necessary to, as they always have, to protect their own skin and advance their own interests, even at the expense of this nation. That's why they don't deserve another 4 years.
Have you seen the motion picture 2016?
No.
It underscores everything you just said. And everybody that's listening, you're listening to Jonathan A. Ward, who is speaking the truth about the person we have sitting in the White House and his ideology and his Saul Alinsky training. He taught at the Alinsky Institute, and if you don't believe it, check it out. Just go Rules for Radicals. You come up with a name. And Mr. Obama was running that institute for some time before he got into he was a public community agitator. And everything you've just said is right. The Jeremiah Wright and Louis Farrakhan connection is very obvious. As a matter of fact, for those of you who doubt this, this is the church that he went to for 20 years. Wright was not only his pastor, but was his mentor and teacher, baptized his children, married he and Michelle. So this is not a passing relationship. And if you want to see a really compact presentation in film of what Jonathan just said to you, go see 2016 America's Obama's America, because it speaks just like about his roots, where he grew up, who he associated with. And by the way, this isn't guilt by association. As somebody said to me when I explained to him, I said, no, this is his resume. This is his resume. These are people he's worked with. These are people he has spent.
Are choices he made. He made the choice to be affiliated with these people and to advance their cause. He wasn't a passive recipient. He didn't happen to get on a bus that was also one in which Reverend Jeremiah Wright happened to be traveling. He viewed Jeremiah Wright, as he previously said, as a surrogate father. He adopted his political viewpoint, and he advocated it. And the only person who changed that was David Axelrod. He acquired an association with David Axelrod when he understood, after he lost his congressional campaign to Bobby Rush in the South Side of Chicago, that he had to do something to appeal to people. They put him together with Axelrod, and Axelrod, who had nothing extraordinary to his name except some good ideas about how to convince people to vote for someone, began to work with Barack Obama and discovered that, hey, look, I think I can make this guy into something. And he convinced Obama that he had to remake himself to be electable. And he started off as a very liberal guy, and which is his preference, far, far left, and that wasn't getting him anywhere politically. So then he had to change his approach, and that succeeded in landing him his election to the United States Senate. And he learned from that he had to remake his public image by carefully grooming it to be something that he is, in his heart of hearts, not. And then, when he ran for president, they had to hurry up and scuttle all his previous associations and distance himself from people like Wright. He met with Wright, according to Edward Klein, late one evening in a private session away from the cameras, where he disabused Wright of the association. And basically, Wright was stunned and said, you would basically slit your own mother's throat in order to advance your own interest. And Obama famously is reported to have said that, don't you understand, there is no loyalty in politics.
Well, this I saw an interview with Jeremiah Wright, who also said that he was offered $150,000 to shut up. And by the
right.
way, your book, the book called The Amateur, as well as this film, 2016, are must read books, just like your book, Restore the Republic. The Amateur is an outstanding book. By the way, Robert Woodward has just come out with a book called The Price of Politics. And the bottom line, this is Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, associate editor, who did all the Watergate reporting. The bottom line in his book, he said, is Obama has failed America. He hasn't failed in his own agenda, but he's failed to deliver the promises of more jobs and more prosperity and so forth and so on, all of which he has no... I mean, I have to tell Jonathan, I really believe that we're in the mess we're in deliberately. I believe that this man in the White House, I mean, when gas prices go, when he was elected, was $1.84, and now we were at Costco the other day and we paid $4.03 a gallon,
$4.07
a gallon, and that's at a discount place when our country is floating in the natural. I mean, just ANWR alone, according to the Wharton School of Economics, could create 800,000 new jobs and provide billions of dollars of tax revenues and business revenues. And ANWR is like 1% of the ANWR reserve. It's like the face of the moon. And for years, politicians have prevented us from getting it. I have to tell you, Jonathan, when the Trans-Alaska pipeline was put in, it was put in by a friend of mine named Lord Cook, who was vice president of ARCO, and he and I were friends. And he told me before the bridge, that the pipeline was being built to bring the crude oil to North America, that the environmentalist wackos were after him, saying he was going to harm the environment, that he was going to kill all the reindeer and the other creatures that were migrating. And he showed me a sketch of the transom, and he showed me all the little pathways they were making, all the tunnels they were making for the animals. He said, we know more, we care more about these environments and these extreme political people that are basically have a political agenda. And he said, Joe, when this Alaska pipeline is built, these, the reindeer and all the caribou, and all, they will flourish. They will love this. And you know what? He was absolutely right. And ANWR is a mere 76 miles away of hooking up with the Trans-Alaska pipeline. And as you said earlier, we could be energy independent if we put our mind to it.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, I think what we've done is basically prop up specific industries at the expense of all others, created a regulatory labyrinth of environmental regulations and restrictions on the national and state level that have made it so costly and difficult for parties to exploit conventional fuel sources in one way or another, that we've put ourselves out of the energy business effectively, and we are in the import business primarily. And I think that that can be changed, and I do believe that if we just would allow for a free market in these areas, we could see enormous benefits, vast increase in employment. I know from dealing with over 450 companies every day who I represent the kinds of problems that these companies experience. These are, by and large, mid-sized to small firms that are struggling to get through a difficult economy. And I can't tell you the number of times that I speak to executives who tell me that if I just had a lower tax burden, corporate tax burden, I could employ many more people. If I just had a less requirement to rely on your services to comply with all these regulations, I might have the financial wherewithal to expand my business, to do more R&D, to have an opportunity to go into markets that I haven't gone into before. All of these things have real consequences. The most idiotic thing you can possibly do if you believe truly in expanding the American pie and restoring the United States to a position where it can pay for its expenses and be great again is to take the sources of wealth in the United States and tax them further. If you take anything, as Obama is offering, anybody who earns $250,000 or more a year would experience a significant tax increase. What will that do? That will increase unemployment. That will increase unemployment because it will do two things. First of all, it's those sources of capital that we rely upon to expand the economy. If you put that in the hands of government instead of the hands of private parties, there will be no expansion of the economy that would otherwise occur. In addition, those same people who are being taxed will become paranoid, as they are right now, but worse so, and you become more conservative. You want to preserve what you have for fear that the government will take it away, the regulatory environment will worsen, the economy overall is going to come down, so you won't make the kind of investments and expansion that you need to employ more people. We have a GDP of 1.3 to 1.7% annually. That is insufficient to grow the economy or to get us out of our financial mess. We need a 3% or greater GDP if we are to survive. We have a 1.7% GDP, and no economist worth a grain of salt predicts that it will increase to 3% within the next decade. That means that we are going to suffer a circumstance in which by 2021, we'll have over $23 trillion in debt. We will have entitlements, but no ability to finance them adequately to cover the services promised. We will have a discretionary budget that is consumed with expenses for non-discretionary matters, making the federal government essentially a mass bureaucratic machine without the financial wherewithal to operate it. The good news is that if you believe in limited government, you can rest assured we're going to get it, because the big government is going to collapse of its own weight, its own extraordinary cost and expense, which is rapidly exceeding our ability to function. We spend over $1.3 trillion presently in excess of what we take in from taxes. If you increase the taxes 100%, on all of the income over $250,000, you raise only $2 trillion. You would reduce the national debt potentially to $14 trillion for a moment, and you would create mass unemployment, and you would have far less revenue to generate for tax purposes in subsequent years. So there's no solution to this through taxation, and there's no ultimate solution to this through deregulation alone. We have to revise the entitlement system in this country and massively reduce the size and scope of the government in the bureaucracy. We have to reduce the national defense establishment. People don't like to hear that, particularly Republicans, but there's a lot of fat to be cut out of the Defense Department, and there are, even are services that we would like to have that we may have to do without. but it is the only way we can save our nation. And we do have to dramatically reduce the expense and the nature of entitlements. And in my book, Restore the Republic, I explain how that can be done. This is not, no one is taking this seriously enough. And the real consequence, you know, in the American Revolution, we had a George Washington. We had someone who in Washington Irving's Life of Washington was willing to fight despite the odds, every prediction that they would be utterly vanquished. And he drove on, through Valley Forge for the purpose of fighting to the end because of the ideal. Because they wanted to be free and willing to sacrifice their lives in order to be free. They were willing to do without everything as long as they could fight for that freedom. And that is the American. That is who the American is. The American is not a European socialist. The American is not a person who is dependent upon government for everything from a hangnail to a easy chair. The American who is worth the great Constitution that was given us is a person who is self-reliant and who is willing to fight and die for freedom. And if we have reached the point where most of us are dependents, where most of us believe that someone else ought to be taxed so that we might have something for nothing, we've lost it.
Well, we have, and I think most people are beginning to realize that for most of human history, the few have ruled over the many for thousands of years, whether it was Pharaoh or the emperor in China or the tribal chiefs in Africa or whatever. The few have always ruled over the many. And when government came up with taxes, people don't understand. The higher the taxes, the less freedom you have. And government spending is another form of taxation. And the problem many people must wake up to is that the United States is unique. There's never been anything like it before in the history of the world. That is common men coming together, just unpretentious people coming together and basing their freedom on the concept that Creator, the architect of all there is, the Creator has not only given us life and nature and the universe, but has given us certain natural rights. And that our founding fathers, you know, they were children of the Enlightenment, but nevertheless, they all came together and believed in a Creator. And what I found really interesting in the last DNC meeting is that they actually took a vote, if you could believe it, about God being included in their platform, as if somehow that was a bad thing, and they had to vote on it, and it was astonishing.
Well, it is extraordinary. You know, it's hard to believe that in less than 300 years, we've gone to a point where a nation that was founded by people who believed that our rights are derived from God and are not given to us by government would come to the point of contemplating rejection of God as having anything to do with the government, so that the notion of, said in correspondence by Thomas Jefferson, of a wall between church and state meant solely for the purpose of ensuring that those who had differing religions could not be forced into a state that would allow for but one, could be transformed into the notion that wherever the state goes, there can be no religion present. And that is antithetical to the free exercise of religion that's embodied within the First Amendment, and also to the sovereignty of the individual. Again, we started with this notion that for the first time in the history of the world, we would recognize that our rights were not simply ones granted to us by leave of a king, as was the divine right of kings, but subsequent to that, the rights revolution that took place in Europe in the Enlightenment era gave birth to the concept that every human being, as a matter of right, has a right to life and to liberty and property that may not be deprived by government. and that must be protected by just governments. And that Lockean concept from his two treatises became the bedrock foundation for but one government in the world, and that's the United States of America. And so that unique gem, that ideological concept that is the fount of all great things, the economic revolution that transformed us from an agrarian society to the wealthiest nation with the highest standard of living in the world, is under attack, so much so that the enemies of it have prevailed by and large and are contemplating the burial of this. And that's what we see when we see a party, a political party, reject God, and a political party that is committed to the furtherance of a welfare state that is unaffordable. We are burying the Republic of the United States. We are telling the world that we will not fight for liberty first and foremost, that we've given up individual sovereignty, and that we're prepared to embrace a European-style socialism in this country and abandon the experiment that had so greatly succeeded. If this occurs, and if 100 years from now we have become indistinguishable from the mediocrity that reigns throughout Europe, then we will look back, the world will look back, and revere those short period, that short period of time when for a moment we embraced the idea that individual liberty was the paramount value and witnessed the rise of such great economic miracles that the world transformed the world. And ironically, as we go and bury these things, other parts of the world have learned our lesson and are going in the opposite direction, like China. And won't it be a shame if we find ourselves to be but a subject of a massive authoritarian Chinese state because we did not rise to the level of protecting human liberty? I think the long-term history of mankind is in favor of liberty. Whether we fight for it or not, it is the natural condition of man to struggle to be free. And as a consequence, we will inevitably see revolutions for liberty again and again and again as that struggle continues. No one is willing to give up their freedom. Barack Obama certainly would not live as a restricted human being under the regulations that he advances. He only finds them acceptable because he's not subject to them and because he can exercise his freedom to impose it upon others without experiencing personally the consequences of that. No doubt if Barack Obama tragically were victimized by some horrible cancer for which there was no FDA treatment, he would get alternative treatments, even though the FDA denies those same treatments to others who are dying haplessly from terminal illnesses for which no FDA-approved drug provides a treatment. No doubt if Barack Obama is in an emergency situation of one kind or another, or even has a great desire for something, there will be a way for him to receive it. If he nationalizes health care in this country beyond the system he's already contemplated, or if the system he's already contemplated renders the provision of medical care mediocre for every American, Barack Obama will be able to receive superior medical care that the rest of America will not. It's his love of himself more than his country that is quintessentially the opposite of what we must have to make America great.
I want to tell everybody you're listening to Jonathan Ebord, our wonderful guest, and you must pick up his book, Restore the Republic, and how we can once again be free and prosperous. Restore the Republic. Jonathan, we have some people on in the chat room that have asked some questions, so let me, if I might, just go through them one at a time. One of them says, he is saying, Romney isn't much better than Obama. Who else can we vote for? I think you addressed that earlier, but I'll let you speak to that now.
Well, I think we have to throw Obama out. We simply can't afford Barack Obama. In a very practical sense, Barack Obama is beyond our collective budget, beyond the budget of the United States, beyond the individual budget in both economic terms and freedom terms for each of us. So we have to vote Barack Obama out of office, which means the only way to do that is to vote for Mitt Romney. And Mitt Romney, I have nothing against Mitt Romney. I just don't have enough for him. I wish he were more than what he is. Having said that, I think he's an honest man. I think he is capable of being pressured into taking the dramatic steps that are necessary to save the nation. I think that the Congress of the United States will be a strong force pressuring him to make dramatic cuts in government. And I think the reality of the economic calamity we are facing will also bear upon his mind seriously in ways that Barack Obama simply does not care to address or consider important. And the reason is that Barack Obama's personal agenda is different than Mitt Romney's. Mitt Romney does love the United States. He is a product of an education and a background that leads him to view free enterprise as a great engine for progress and for restoration of society. He knows that he can trust in free enterprise. He believes in that system. He believes in individual liberty. He's an advocate of this nation's core values. And so, as a result, he is a safe bet. Is he the answer, ultimately? Well, he can choose to be that or not. Do I think he has all the answers? No, I don't. Do I think that he can be a great president? Yes, I believe he can be a great president. Do I think Barack Obama can be a great president? I know absolutely the answer to that question from his 4 years in office. The answer is he is not simply a bad president. He is a ruinous president. He's going to destroy the future for generations that are coming up, and he is going to take from this nation and pillage it and ruin it beyond even the economic devastation the country's experiencing at present. So I don't think there's any question but that we have to, if we love this country, vote for Mitt Romney.
I couldn't agree with you at all. You know, I, as a person who worked for Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan, which Mitt is not, but he's heading the right direction. I mean, we have, that's a wonderful answer. I have another question, and Janet's been writing him down, and she's working with the program. Janet, would you share this question with Jonathan, please?
Hey, Jonathan. The question is, how is the Fed buying $40 billion in mortgages going to get people's mortgage payments reduced if the banks still won't lend on these reduced rates?
That's an excellent question with the answer built into the question. It's not going to work. They've already done this, by the way, for many hundreds of billions of dollars of this same sort of thing, and it has had virtually no effect. I think it's a desperation move on the part of the Fed, and I think it comes about because there's no responsible leadership in Congress, and I think Bernanke is just petrified, as the entire Fed is, that we're going to slip into economic oblivion in the not-too-distant future, and I believe that we will, no matter what the Fed does. I think this will not work. The only thing, we would have a dramatic change in the United States for the better if we just did a few things. If we eliminated the personal income tax, and at the same time, as I explain in my book, cut out all this government spending that I've advocated doing, we could create an economic miracle the likes of which we have never seen in this country before. And the reason is all of that money that the 50% of the Americans who pay taxes are pumping into the federal government, they would keep in their pockets, and they would spend, and they would save, and they would invest. And this would produce such enormous ripples throughout the economy and create this sense of exuberance and would unleash so much economic activity and so much profit-making that this nation would turn itself around within the course of 6 months to a year and would start growing that economic pie again. And then if we would do the additional smart thing of these enterprise zones that I'm talking about, we could really reduce substantially the unemployment in this country and grow the economy and create an economic miracle. That is just not possible with Barack Obama. That is not even in the cards. He would never think of such a thing. He has no faith in the individual. He has no faith in the private sector or free enterprise. He has absolute faith in government planning. He believes in creating a dictated future where all of us must live by the rules he prescribes. He loves himself. He loves his ideas. He thinks all of us should agree with his ideas, and all of us should live the way he wishes to prescribe our lives. He wants a green future for us. He wants us all to be investing in and supporting green enterprise. He will spend billions of tax dollars on failed green enterprise operations that accept the money and turn around and go bankrupt. He is happy to do that because he wants us to have a green energy future. Whether or not the market wishes to have that is of no consequence to him.
Jonathan, I truly believe that he wants us all, you know, on the dole to the government so that he can control us all.
I don't think he has any desire to do anything really beyond enhancing his own status. He uses executive orders that circumvent the normal lawmaking process to achieve his objectives. He is willing to sign legislation that would allow the United States military to arrest on suspicion of association with terrorists any American citizen and not bring them up on charges and keep them detained indefinitely and not be enable them to have the right of writ of habeas corpus. These are the kinds of things that a dictator does. These are the kinds of things that someone who does not care about rights does. If you cared, if protection of individual rights, which is what our Declaration is designed to make this country be, the Declaration explains that we are all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, and that among them are life, liberty, and property, and that just governments are instituted among men to protect those rights. And when it becomes no longer the centerpiece of government to protect those rights, and when a president of the United States cavalierly signs legislation that would deprive you of those rights, uses means to achieve his ends, even if it circumvents the elected representatives of the people in Congress, this is a man who really does not basically believe in individual rights. They are a convenience. If it promotes his agenda, support rights, he will support them. If it doesn't support his agenda, then he'll violate them. This is a dangerous man. Barack Obama has been a very dangerous president, very ruinous to this country. That the American people, by and large, don't see that now is a great disappointment to me. I love this country, and I wish it would be the other way around, but hopefully before it's too late, they will see it.
We have one more question we need to get in because we're about out of time here, and that question was, once the Supreme Court makes a decision on the scope of interstate commerce, how can they reverse it or limit it?
It's a good question. The court in the Obamacare decision actually got it right on the Commerce Clause. They determined that the law was not constitutional under the Commerce Clause. Where they got it wrong, where Justice Roberts got it wrong in my view, is that he took the tax clause and he said that this was constitutional under the tax clause. Well, this is a regulation of the market. It's not a tax. It was designed to impose a penalty for noncompliance. The word tax is not referenced. The word penalty is referenced in the statute. So why did he uphold it as a tax? But more importantly, what his precedent establishes is that Congress may regulate down to the individual level without regard to the Commerce Clause under the tax provision, so long as they include a penalty with the statute. So that no longer do you have to prove that something complies with the regulatory provision, the Commerce Clause. You can just ignore the Commerce Clause and say it's a taxing provision and regulate through the taxing provision. Well, the taxing provision was never meant to be the basis for national regulation. It's simply a revenue raiser. And this statute was not designed to raise revenue. If people pay a penalty, it doesn't cover the cost of Obamacare. And furthermore, if everyone complies with the order under Obamacare, no money is raised. So clearly this isn't a revenue raiser. So that act of leisure domain is ruinous, and it's a precedent that's very damaging. because it allows henceforth Congress of the United States to regulate down to the most intimate level any aspect of human conduct based solely on the tax provision without regard to the Commerce Clause.
Well, you've been listening to Jonathan Ebert, our special guest on this edition of You Are What You Love. We're just about run out of time. Thank you so much, Jonathan. You've been an inspiration. Everybody, go get the book, Restore the Republic, by Jonathan E. Mord, E-M-O-R-D, and learn how you can once again help make this country flourish and be prosperous. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're a great American, Joe. Good to be with you.
Thank you, Janet.
You've
Thanks,
been listening
everyone.
To You Are What You Love with author Waishali. To order Waishali's book, You Are What You Love, or to schedule a private self-emergent session with Waishali, visit youarewhatyoulove.com. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you are what you love, and you love whatever you give your attention to. So love wisely.